Boker Tov, I think we can get started. Hope everybody's doing well. Welcome. Okay, we were in the middle of Mishnah 14 in the fourth chapter, at least in my series, chapter number 14, Perek Dalet, Mishnah Yud Dalet, Rav Nehurai Omer. So we were discussing that heavy gola, the Makom Torah. You have to exile yourself to a place of Torah. And we discussed last week a debate. Whether that's an ideal, like, yes, the only way to really learn is to go away. And we discussed, like, American kids have got to go to Israel, you know, to really get into learning. And sometimes when, you know, your home environment, it's just there are too many distractions, etc. So everybody, and that's the view of some of the commentaries, that Hevi Gola L'Makom Torah is a sort of a command almost, you know, that's what you should do. And others, the Bartanura, the most important commentary on the Mishnah, disagrees. He says, this is, even if you have to, of course it's better to be at home. And you shouldn't have to exile yourself to study Torah. Torah should be where you are. Why do you have to go away to study Torah? Torah, I mean, I know it's not exactly what he's talking about, but let's say when Avraham Avinu was praying for a storm, he said, Ulayesh kamishim tzadikim betoch, in the midst of the city. And the Ibn Ezra notes, to be at Tzaddik, you know, when you're in Yeshiva in the ivory tower, it's no big deal. To be at Tzaddik on Wall Street, on Bay Street, that's a big deal. So heavy goal in the Makom Torah, we don't want to go away in a pure atmosphere where there's no other distractions and anything. I that's not exactly what he said. He just, but he may mean that. I'm not sure. But what the Bartanura says is, if you have to be, if you have Torah teachers where you live, why do you have to go anywhere else? And of course, we said there's no real answer to that question. And I think it depends on historical factors, depends on personal factors, and everybody's different. And some people, you know, thrive when they're away, and some people thrive when they're at home. So that's okay. We discussed a little bit last week. So then we were discussing who was Rav Nehurai. And we said one opinion, he's Rav Meir. And we discussed the contradiction, because Rav Nehurai, and this would also add impetus to this Mishnah, Rav Nehurai is quoted in the last Mishnah in Kiddushin as saying that he's only going to teach his children Torah. That's it. I forget all the university and doctors and lawyers, investment bankers. Torah. We're pure Torah, like the chief rabbi of Israel said this week. Only Torah. We shouldn't have any other education. And that's not, of course, the accepted view, at least what for sure was not the accepted view in Talmudic times. In that same Mishnah, Rabbi Meir disagrees. And Rabbi Meir says, no, you should teach your child umnut kala unikia. And we know through Talmudic sources, you have to teach a clean, pure profession. What that is, that's very hard to know. In today's society, clean means kala vinikia means, kala means, this I don't think we spoke about at all last week. Kala means you work 9 to 5 or 9 to 12. You know, the one of the strangest Rambams in all of the Mishnah Torah. I don't know, strange, like an impossible Rambam. The Rambam is describing people who work. We know the Rambam was the most anti-kolo person in Jewish history. Of all our rabbinic greats, the Rambam says a person who takes money for the study of Torah loses his share in the world to come. I didn't make this up. That's what the Rambam writes. He's pretty, it's black and white. You can't miss it. And we know the Rambam became a doctor so to support himself. He refused to take any communal funds. And the Rambam was very anti-taking any money. But that, so the, what is, so the Rambam says, okay, so you have to work and you have to learn. You have to do both. So, okay, what should you do? So you should work 3 hours a day. Make a living 3 hours a day, and you learn 9 hours a day. According to the Rambam, you have to sleep 8 hours a day, right? He didn't sleep 8 hours a day. So that's already 20 hours. You're working for 3, learning for 9. That's 12. 8 hours to sleep. That's 20. Got 4 hours a day to eat and to schmooze and to talk to your family and whatever, do homework. That's a schedule that's, of course, halavai people in yeshiva should learn 9 hours a day. But kala does have the implication if you're working every day till 11 o'clock at night. And when, which unfortunately is, you have to do sometimes in some profession, and that's the only way to make a parnasa almost with the expense. It's very hard, but umnat kala v'nikia in theory means, kala means you have time to get involved in the community, time to study Torah, And Nikia means it's morally upright. I don't have to tell you, certain professions lend itself to not the highest of moral standards. And we're all influenced by our environment, even on a very much lighter plane. But I remember many years ago, I read an article in a book, Beryl Wine, who's a fantastic, one of the great rabbis in North America, community rabbis. So as I'm sure many of you know, Beryl Wine, he's Baruch Hashem, I think he's doing well. He must be close to 90. I think he still speaks in Yerushalayim as a rabbi in a shul. So he was a lawyer for 9 years. It probably helped him a lot in his rabbinate. Anyway, so he writes that the first day on his job, the first day that he's working, he forgot to daven mincha. I assume he was starting to fall. He forgot, he wants to impress it. He said, oh my God, one day in the law world. Now, no one's saying you shouldn't become a lawyer and whatever. And that's not what we're saying. We're saying that we're all influenced by our environment and it's impossible. It's impossible not to be. It's also very hard. So you have to choose a profession that won't, be morally debilitating. I don't know what that means today either. See, if people want to help out and give advice, how you can make a living, have time for Torah, umna kalam kiyah, but that's what you're supposed to do. It probably was a lot easier. You work on a kibbutz, work on a farm. That's as the Torah describes it. It's probably farming also was hard. Farming also that this year is a Shemitah year because the farmers didn't have enough time. That one of the reasons the comment Torah doesn't tell us exactly why. It says it's a Shabbat to Hashem, a Shabbat to God. Just like the weekly Shabbat, we rest, we acknowledge God as our master creator. So once a year, we acknowledge God as our master owner of the land. Okay, but the Bede Karmter Spain, take a year off to learn a sabbatical. But okay, farming is very busy at certain times. You're not busy. I don't know. But anyways, Umda Kalav Nikia. That's Rav Meir. And Rav Nuhurai says, you should learn, only teach my children Torah. And we said, so how can they be the same person? So we explained that's not really, I don't think it's a contradiction because one can, for most people, learn. We have exceptions for every rule. Everything has exceptions, sir. And we do believe in, we don't accept the view of the Rambam that it's forbidden to take money for a Torah. Maybe on a broad scale, but the people who deserve it should take whatever. So that's not necessarily a contradiction. And the Ryan may, of course, mean the same thing, light. But what I want to focus on now is the other opinions. This Mishnah, Hevi Golel the Makom Torah. So this Mishnah is quoted in the Gemara. I mean, there is no Gemara, as I'm sure many of you know, on Pirkei Avot. In fact, I don't know how many people know. I believe it's only 37. I may be even wrong. I may be off by one. Today, we're starting Masechet Sukkah in Daf Yomi. Today's Daf Yomi, we start in Sukkah. But there are 63 tractates in the Talmud. Only 36 or 37 of them actually have Gemara on them. Even if you learn Daf Yomi, Daf Yomi off by heart, you got like 1% of rabbinic literature. You got a slice. I don't mean the Mishnayot, most Mishnayot have no Gemara. And Pirkei Avot, of course, is one of them. Mainly it's Rayim, laws of agriculture, the laws of purity in Torah, because those laws didn't apply. The rabbis were much less interested in theoretical, study. The rabbis said, we learn l'mod al menot la'asot l'kayem, we learn to do. This idea that we learn for the sake of learning was not, it's not really, you don't get that impression. When you study the Talmud, when you look at our traditional sources, learning was for the purpose of doing, of keeping lishmor v'lasot, and everybody went to work. They had no kololim in the time of the Gemara. So today, that's really probably an innovation of Rav Chaim Valazhin in the Valazhin Yeshiva, the student of the Vilna Gaon in 1803 when he founded the yeshiva. So he developed the notion of Torah lishma, Torah just learning and nothing to do with reality. You learn, there's no difference, and that's become the dominant view. Rav Soloveitchik basically held like that. And they're not saying the practical isn't important, God forbid. That's not what they're saying. But Talmud Torah, you're connecting to God, you're studying God's work. It's irrelevant if it has a practical benefit. And anybody who studied in yeshiva, no, most yeshivot don't care about the practical stuff. One of the, I don't know what you want to call it. A tragedy would be too strong a word. It depends on who you ask. But one of the results of the Lithuanian yeshiva world is that most Lithuanian scholars didn't know how to paskin halakha. They disconnected the Talmud from halakha. There was a disconnect. Halacha was the theoretical framework, as the Rav Soloveitchik describes his grandfather, that the laws of kashrut are not about pots and pans. They're about theoretical concepts and abstract ideas and what they represent. It's very nice, but you know what? When you work in the kitchen, you have pots and pans, and you have to know if they are kosher. But that was the Lithuanian approach to Torah study. It's independent of its practical benefits, and perhaps it's even on a higher level. You're studying, you know, lishma, totally for its own sake, without any practical idea. But that's a modern concept. Last 200 years, that concept did not exist in our culture. We always have that into the study of intellectual history, when ideas come in and become popular. But anyways, getting back to here, so you have to, the Mishnah, the rabbis didn't write Gemara on those parts of the Mishnah that were no longer applicable. And since the Gemara was written outside of the land of Israel, the Talmud Bavli, and it was written, parts of it, hundreds of years already. It was edited in the year 500, final editing, and even beyond that, the Savarim did other edits for hundreds of years after the temple. So they're not going to sit there and discuss the laws of purity and impurity at no relevance. There is one exception, that where the rabbis did discuss things that were irrelevant, and it's in the Gemara, their whole Talmudic tractates. Anybody know what that might be? What Talmudic tractates have that are of no practical importance today? Nobody's learning Daf Yomi. That's okay. We haven't learned it for a few years. So basically, Kodshim, like Zvachim and Menachot, the laws of sacrifices are fully discussed. How do you bring a flower sacrifice, the animal sacrifice? All the technical details are discussed. Even we just finished yesterday in Masechet Yuma on Yom Kippur. 7 of the 8 chapters of Yuma have nothing to do with the Yom Kippur of today. They have to do with the Yom Kippur in the temple. Only the 8th and final chapter is what we call Yom Kippur, doing tshuva and have to fast, etc., etc. The exception is when it comes to sacrifices, and that's based on the fact of the verse we say it on Shabbat Shuvah, I believe, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the Haftorah, Shuva Hashem Ad Yisrael, Shuva Yisrael Ad Hashem Elokecha, Unishalma Parim Sifatenu. Our lips will replace the korbanot. That's where people get the notion prayer is a replacement of korbanot. Not exactly accurate that it's a replacement or korbanot, but whatever. That's for another discussion. But the idea that our rabbis developed based on this verse is that when we say the korbanot, it's as if we're actually bringing them somehow. So we have to understand what that means exactly. But somehow the rabbis understood that sacrifice, if I study the laws of purity, or if I study the laws of something that don't apply, so what? So I'm studying it. So maybe there's a mitzvah of study Torah, but it's not like I'm doing the action. When you study the laws of korbanot, our rabbis considered it as if you're bringing a korban. That's why the opening parts of our Siddur that most people skip, but the korbanos, you know, they're only, you know, the old men come to shul early, they say korbanos, you know, but all that stuff, Eisa Makoma and then korban tamid, and because the idea is that that's what we should bring every day, a korban tamid. So when we can bring it, we can bring it, but if we can't bring it, we should talk about it, we should learn about it. So that obviously was a very strong idea, because the rabbis decided to have hundreds of pages of discussion about things that had zero applicability. There were no korbanos. They didn't have those discussions about Truma and Maser, and unfortunately they didn't have those discussions about Shemitah, because they didn't think about the revised state of Israel and Jews coming back and creating a state and now having to worry about Shemitah. So we're at a loss. That's why there's so much discussion what to do on Shemitah, because the Talmud doesn't talk about it. In the Mishnah, yeah, the Mishnah is about everything, but the Mishnah isn't quite enough, doesn't have enough details, so whatever. So the laws of sacrifice are different, that even though they're of no practical benefit, they're still a mitzvah to study. And I think I may have mentioned once before, now, Rav Schechter would often say that he quotes Rabbeinu Yonah, the famous Rabbeinu Yonah from the brother-in-law, I think, of the Ramban, Rabbeinu Yonah in Gerona, the brother-in-law or a cousin of the Ramban, Nachmanides, and the author of the classic work on Shuvah, commentary on the Talmud. So he writes that saying korbanot is a biblical mitzvah. to daven outside of the Rambam, davening is only a rabbinic mitzvah. The Rambam's the only authority who holds that davening is a biblical mitzvah. All other authorities hold davening is it's a rabbinic mitzvah to daven. To say korbanot, oh, that's in the Torah. Last week's parsha, Pinchas, the korban tamid. So that's a biblical mitzvah. Psukei de Zimra is not even a rabbinic mitzvah. Psukei de Zimra is midat chasidut, an act of piety. If you're a very pious Jew, so you can say Ashrei and Hallelujah and Az Yashir and Hodu. That's for the pious people. Baruch Shamar, midat chasidut. That's what the Gemara says. No, midat chasidut. It's okay if you don't do it. That's why the halach is: if you come late to shul, you skip Psukei de Zimra. And right for that's important for me. I don't know, maybe not important for you, but for people who come late to shul, it's important to know what parts you should skip. So you're supposed to skip Psukei de Zimra to daven Shmon Esrei. That's the real takana. That's the real prayer with the congregation. So Rev Schachter would often tell us it's more important to say korbanot than Psukei de Zimra. You should say all the korbanot and skip Psukei de Zimra. No, I'm not recommending that necessarily. I used to do that for a long time. I would say korbanot and skip Psukei de Zimra. I can tell you, I don't know I don't do that anymore. I say korban tamid. I used to say all korbanos. I used to taka when I was in the shir, and for many years afterwards, I said the entire korbanot. I don't know, maybe echatay ani maskir hayom, whatever. Today, I only say the korban tamid. I say that by Devar Hashem Moshe Leimor, because that was brought every day. On Shabbos, I add Yom HaShavan. On Rosh Chodesh, tomorrow, I'll add Rosh Chodeshim, and I say the Ola and from Ezu Mekoman. But there was a time I would be very strict on korbanot and Psukei de Zimra. Half the time I would miss it, because even if you come to shul on time, but if the shul skips korbanos, you know, you have to catch up somewhere. Anyways, that's as an aside, sort of. But learning was always assumed to be practical in the time of the Talmud. That's the reason to learn. Okay, so let's get back here. Havigola lemakom Torah. So. The Gemara, so this Mishnah is quoted in the Gemara. That's where we started that whole thing, right? Quoted in the Gemara, how many Mishnah, Peseder. It's quoted in Masechet Shabbat, in the famous, in the story we mentioned last year when we learned about the students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who perhaps the best student, Rav Elazar ben Arach. Rav Elazar ben Arach was the one who, one opinion is if every rabbi was on one side and he was on the other side, he would outweigh them. Right, he was the greatest rabbi. And the problem with Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, as many of you may know or may not know, is we never hear of him again. He disappears. The other students of Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Elazar Gadol, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Yoshua, these are the famous rabbis. We hear about them all the time. These are the rabbis of the Mishnah, but Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, he disappears from Jewish history. So the Gemara says what happened. The Gemara quotes this teaching because the Gemara says they had spas, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, he hung out at the spa. All the rabbis went to study in Yavne or wherever they went, and he was interested in going to the spa. What's the exact name? Maya did the Yustamit and Chamra de Pergituta. The Gemara says, these places, nice, relaxing, so that's why the Asarat Shvatim, it's a funny Gemara, the 10 tribes were lost because they were, as Rashi is saying, they were so into seeking pleasure. And they, you know, forgot about Torah. I don't know. And then they were dispersed. They were, whatever it is, he connects that. And then the Gemara says Rabbi Elazar ben Arach did the same thing, and that's the famous story. He forgot all his Torah. It can't be literal, the story. He was the greatest Torah scholar in the world, and then he went on vacation. Okay, go to vacation a little bit. You have to. That's a good idea. He went for 5 years, 10 years. He hung out. There were no Torah scholars. There was nobody there, and he forgot everything. And when he came back to visit, they gave him an aliyah in shul. It was Parshat HaChodesh. And instead of saying HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, this month is for you, he said HaCheresh Yelibam. Chodesh and Cheresh, right? The Dalin and the Resh, they look very similar. Lachem Libam, the Chaf and the Beit, right? Left to you, your heart. Of course, the power of the imagery is beautiful. HaChodesh Yelachem is the forming of the Jewish nation, set up a calendar, the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people. HaCheresh HaYelibam, your hearts were deaf. I mean, it's obviously a critique. That's a story. It's not literal, but it's a beautiful idea how he misplayed the word, but it's the idea behind it. He was deaf. His heart was deaf. The rabbis said they prayed for him. So the Gemara says, you learn, you should be gola lemakom Torah. The Gemara quotes that story, and instead of being gola, instead of going on, the tourism industry is hoping to get back. You know, people are beginning to fly. Baruch Hashem, let's hope it we get back to normal a lot of it. So, you know, people be gola to a makom Torah. Don't be gola to who knows where for a year to travel around the world in 81 days or 365 days, go around the world and forget everything. So the Gemara quotes this story. And then the Gemara has an amazing comment. They say, you know who Rav Elazar ben Aruch was? His real name was Rav Nehurai. In other words, again, I don't know if that's true, but the Gemara is equating. In other words, it's saying that story, Rav Elazar ben Aruch is the one. It's not just we should learn. Rav Elazar ben Aruch should have learned what Rav Nehurai said. Rav Elazar ben Aruch is Rav Nehurai. That's one opinion. So again, the Gemara quotes a few opinions, so that's one opinion. So I don't know if the Gemara, we said already, one opinion is he was Rav Meir, but another opinion is Rav Elazar ben Aruch. Obviously, the rabbis are not telling us biographical information. They're telling us ideological information, the idea, the concept, but it's sort of a beautiful idea. In other words, that's his tshuva. In other words, he went there and then he realized the mistake he made. And then he says, okay, have you go there? Lemakom Torah. Okay, enough of that. If anybody has any questions, feel free to interrupt. Okay, now the Mishnah then continues. What does it say? Altomar Shevoach Arecha, the Torah won't become after you. Don't say that. You have to seek out Torah. Don't wait till Torah comes to you. Sort of the same idea. Go to place, be proactive. Vabinatal Tisha'ein, and do not rely on your own wisdom. So this is the idea of getting out their opinion. We believe, you know, we have an official opposition. The role of the official opposition is to critique if they do their job, you know, properly. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. It rarely works that way. But the idea is that you shouldn't learn alone. Al binatcha al tishein, or that's because, and I think there's the rabbis have a beautiful expression. We know the classical way of learning is with a chevruta, with a study partner, and the study partner is supposed to argue with you. You walk into a Beit Midrash and people are yelling at each other. You know, people who have never seen this, you know, they had this, the famous story of the cardinals came to, I think they went to YU and YCT. I don't remember the whole story there, but a bunch of cardinals, not the St. Louis cardinals, but the cardinals in the Vatican, wanted to see what it's like to learn in the yeshiva. And they were like blown away. First of all, that we study texts that are 2,000 years old. It's like unbelievable in the original language. I mean, who studies in Latin? You go to a kollel for priests, they study in Latin and they're screaming at each other. You don't have, so they were like blown away by this whole idea, but it's noisy, they're arguing. So the Gemara has a play on words that when two people learn, they're oivim, they're enemies. In other words, the role of your chavruta, not an enemy the way we would say it in English. It has the connotation means, you know, a disputant. The role of the chavruta is not to accept what you say, is to argue, to question, to critique. That's the role of the student. You should be critiquing me, arguing with me, questioning me for sure. But when they finish learning, they become ohavim. That's oyev and ohev is a little bit of plain word. Not, they don't leave achinasum ohavim. When they're studying, they're enemies, but when they leave, they're beloved, because the idea of study is to get to the truth, to reach to what's the truth, and they're helping each other. It's a famous story. Rav Yochanan and the Reish Lakish, you know, were brother-in-laws, and after Reish Lakish died, Rav Yochanan, which may be the fault of Rav Yochanan, but that's another story. He made a caustic comment to him once, and that broke off their relationship. A very tragic story, as the Talmud presents it. But anyways, after Reish Lakish died, Rav Yochanan was all depressed. And so they sent him a chavrusa. I forget who they sent him to learn. And the problem was, Rav said, everything Rav Yochanan would say, you're right. Rav Yochanan, he's brilliant. And they said, Rav Yochanan, I can't learn with you. Everything I learned, Reish Lakish had 24 questions. 24 questions, 24 answers. Anything. You just agree with me. You nod your head. I don't need you to tell me I'm right. I know I'm right. I need you to tell me why I'm wrong. So he couldn't learn with him. And he went crazy. The Gemara says, and they prayed for him and he died, because he couldn't live. It's an unbelievable story in Bava Metzia. Maybe we have to discuss it in greater detail another time. But that's the idea, learning with Al Binatcha Al Tishen. Always learn with a Chavrusa. Now, the truth of the matter is, anybody also will tell you, you need time on your own. And I think this also perhaps an age thing when you're younger. I think, you know, when I was younger, I always learned with the Chavruta. Today, I almost never learn with the Chavruta. I mean, I learn with my kids, Baruch Hashem, a little bit. And I sometimes learn with other people here and there. But it's different as you, I don't know, maybe it's wrong also. I mean, I want people to criticize or to critique, to question me. But of course, you reach a certain point, and obviously that's, you know, and you're doing your own research and your own learning. But the classical learning, and it should always be with the shir, with either with a teacher, a colleague, a chavrutza. Anyway, so that's, it's interesting that, you know, one of the first art scroll books I ever read was My Uncle the Netziv. Anybody read that book? So I should, if you have a look there in the back, okay, I can pull it out later. So the Torah Tamima, that's Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein.
That was the book that was censored.
Yes, of course, of course. That's of course. That's why I read it. Right, it was banned. It wasn't censored. The book was banned. That's why, if it was censored, I wouldn't have read it necessarily. But that, you want to get your books selling, get some rabbis to ban it. That's the best method for sales. It depends on which world you live in. But the Torah Tamima was quite a fascinating personality. And we won't go into him now, but it's a great bar mitzvah present. He wrote a commentary on the Chumash, famous comment. He brought in all the Talmudic passages that relate to the verses in the Torah. So the Torah Tamima, actually, he did this during World War I, I believe. He didn't have his books. There was dislocation. I mean, it was a terrible time. I mean, obviously, we don't think of World War I because we think of the horrors of World War II. So we forget World War I was pretty awful. And many Jews were killed. And it was awful time. And people were uprooted and et cetera. So he couldn't learn. So the Torah Tamima said, I don't have my sparim. I'm running up. So he wrote a biography. He wrote a family history. 2,000 pages. Fascinating. They're Sephardim. His name is Epstein. Epstein's pretty Ashkenazi. I believe he says his name is Benavisti. They were from the Spanish exiles. And then, I don't know, somebody must have married an Ashkenazi. It's a fascinating, I haven't read the whole thing. I've read excerpts. It's a four-volume green. I have it in the back there. The Makor Baruch, for Baruch Levi Epstein, the Makor Baruch. So he wrote this book of 2,000 pages. Now, he was the nephew of the Netziv, the Rosh Yeshiva in Valashin, Rav Chaim of Valashin, we spoke about earlier, developed this idea of Torah Lishma, learning disconnected from practice. The Netziv was the Rosh Yeshiva of the last 45 years. He married the Rav Chaim of Valashin's granddaughter. That always helps in the yeshiva world. I mean, he earned it. There were fights in Valashin, well-known fights between who should be Rosh Yeshiva. It didn't just go on family biography, but it never hurts to marry the Rosh Yeshiva's daughter if you want to become a Rosh Yeshiva, the Nisib was an unbelievable person. Don't think there was any nepotism with him. As a matter of fact, he tried to appoint his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, you know, the yeshiva on Coney Island in Brooklyn, right? That's Rav Chaim Berlin. So the Netziv tried to appoint his son as a Rebbe, and there was a revolt of the students. They said he's not good enough, and there was a revolt, and he couldn't teach there. The students back then were much more active than they are today, aggressive. Today, they're much more, whatever, docile, I think. But he got thrown out. But then Netziv was an unbelievable person. So he, Art Scroll, about 35 years ago in the 80s, Art Scroll published excerpts, 150 pages on this book. It's excerpts from the Torah Tamima. Translated into English about the parts that relate to his relationship with his uncle, the Netziv. Because in the book, he tells stories. He learned in Valashin for 5 years. He lived in his uncle's house. So he knew his uncle pretty well. Now, when the Art Scroll book was published, there was nobody alive who knew the Netziv. It's 100 years after he died. Like, there was no living person who ever spoke to the Netziv. But the Torah Tamima lived in his house for 5 years. So anyways, Art Scroll sent out the book, or not Art Scroll. Arts Grove published the book. Lakewood Yeshiva sent out the book. You know this whole story. Lakewood Yeshiva sent out this book as a fundraising thing. You know, you send a present to somebody to ask for money. They don't do that anymore. Or maybe I'm not on the mailing list. I don't know. But so they sent out this book. And then a month later, they sent out a letter banning the, you shouldn't read the book. God forbid, the book doesn't reflect the hashkafas. I don't want to get into the whole parsha. That's not our shiur now. But why was one of the reasons? I already said too much. One of the reasons they banned the book, which of course inspired me to read it, was that the Netziv writes that if the Rambam would have had a chavrusa, he wouldn't have made so many mistakes. Because anybody who learns in yeshiva knows the Rambam contradicts himself left and right. Now, the co-Rosh Yeshiva of the Netziv was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik revolutionized the methodology of Talmudic study. We're talking before about intellectual history. Rav Chaim developed, he developed, there were strands of it earlier, but it was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik who developed this, the Brisker approach, what we call today, the conceptual analytical approach to Talmudic study, where it's no longer a debate between the Rambam and the Ravid who's right. That was the old style, the Rambam and the Ravid debate. So this one brings a proof to here. No, he's right, he's wrong. This Talmud supports him. The Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, they're both right. But this has one concept, this has another concept. This analyzes this idea from here. So depending on how you look at it, they're both. That was, I mean, in 1 second, that's a brief, unsophisticated approach to how the Brisker Derech worked. We no longer have debates, we have concepts, and each one is looking at it differently. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, of course, who was the co-Rosh Yeshiva within the Siva, and then he had to leave and whatever. So his whole life of Brisker's is to resolve contradictions in the Rambam. The same way the Rambam and the Ravid aren't arguing, the Rambam's not arguing with himself. But if you don't know from sophisticated, whatever, like you sit there, the Rambam contradicts himself, of course, left and right. So then it's even new. He wrote, everybody contradicts himself. You write 5 million words. You write 5,000, 1,000 chapters in the Mishnah Torah. You know, the Mishnah Torah is exactly 1,000 chapters. That is not a coincidence. The Rambam, besides being the greatest genius of the last 1,000 years and the greatest interpreter of Jewish law and the greatest philosopher, was a stylistic. His style is amazing. And he had and his codification method. Dov Friedberg in Toronto, that was his PhD, trying to figure out how the Rambam puts his 613 mitzvah in what order, his classification. It's a tremendous study. So he has 1,000 chapters. You write 1,000 chapters, and you write a commentary to the Mishnah, and you write a philosophical, you write 20 letters, so you're going to say things, and over a 50-year career, of course you contradict yourself. So then it's because the Rambam contradicts himself. So, and then the Tziv said, had the Rambam had a chavrusa, the chavrusa would have pointed out some of these errors in the Rambam and he would have fixed them. No. So that didn't go over so well in certain circles. Okay. So if you want, I don't know if the book's available anymore. I don't know if you want to read it, but read the original. Of course, the original's in Hebrew, 2,000 pages. It'll take you a long time to. I haven't even read it yet. Read parts of it. Okay. That's enough fun. That's now that gets. Okay. Let's move on to the next Mishnah. Okay, Mishnah Tetva, Rav Yanai Omer. So here we have again, Rav Yanai, the only time he appears in Talmudic, in Mishnaic like literature. Often these rabbis are quoted in Talmud, in the Gemara. But we've mentioned a number of times, there are, I believe, 22 rabbis who appear in Pirkei Avot and nowhere else, because everybody has a specialty in learning, right? Every doctor, every professional, a lawyer, this, that. So the rabbis had specialties. So of course, you know that. And in certain tractates, certain rabbis are quoted more often. Nobody can be an expert, the expert in everything. Maybe the Rambam. So experts in moral teaching, ethic, character development. So Rav Yanai, this is one. He's appears only in Pirkei Avot, only here, not only just in Pirkei Avot, just here. What does he say? Ein bi'adenu, we do not have in our hands. Lo mishalvat harisha'im, not the peace of the wicked, but af, and even, even more so, we don't have in our hands. Yisurei hatzadikim, the suffering of the righteous. We do not have in our hands, this is the literal translation, the shalva. Shalva is the tranquility, I guess is the best word perhaps, of the wicked, or the suffering of the righteous. So what does this mean? So we basically have two, and then we'll add perhaps a third interpretation. Is this a philosophical statement, or is this a practical statement about how our life works in practice, or how our life, how is it theological? So we'll start with the theological, which basically the theological, it would be the simple idea, the very difficult idea, but the simple problem, or the complex, but the well-known problem of theodicy. How could it be that the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? That's the age-old question from Moshe Rabbeinu through Eov, of course, through all Jewish history. And of course, we don't know God's way. So the simple explanation, that's the first explanation of Bartender. We can't understand the shalva of the Rashaim. Why do the wicked people have peace and tranquility? And why do righteous people suffer? That's the very basic, simple interpretation. Makes a lot of sense. You're not going to be able to know. You can philosophize all you want, and it's important, and the question should trouble you, but don't think you can solve the problem. It's insolvable. We don't aim via denu. It's not in our hands. We cannot grasp it. We cannot understand why the wicked sometimes prosper and why the evil and why the righteous do not. Of course, one simple idea, and this doesn't explain it on an individual basis, but I've often just to point out, the world has to work that way, because if every time you did something right, you got a reward, and every time you did something wrong, you were punished, we wouldn't have any free choice. We would turn it into robots, right? If every time you ate non-kosher food, you got a stomachache, like, or a high fever, and you had to be in bed for a week. And every time you ate kosher food, you felt great. So nobody would eat non-kosher food. So that would be meaningless. The kosher food has to taste good. In other words, as the Rambam writes, you should want to eat non-kosher food. I wrote this week, if anybody saw Eating a Cheeseburger, where I said, the Gemara sometimes said, you should eat a cheeseburger, but that's a different story. If a person's going to be unethical, better to eat a cheeseburger than to be kosher and create a chilul Hashem. But anyway, the Rambam says, a religious Jew, one who's ethical, I want to eat a cheeseburger, but I can't. The Torah says, if I don't eat a cheeseburger because it's poison, it makes me sick, so that doesn't mean anything. So the world has to exist as if, I always like to say, the world exists as if there is no God. I know that's heretical, but it's also, if you understand what I'm meaning, in other words, we have to put a roof around a fence around our roof. The Torah said, Kino fell, and he's going to fall anyway. You shouldn't be the cause. God determines you're going to die anyway. What difference does it make if you have a fence? You know, the fatalistic attitude. No, maybe it doesn't make a difference. You should not be the cause. You don't worry about God. Ain't some chimelanes. You don't. So the world has to exist as if they're sort of by natural means. We don't rely on miracles. God, so the world exists. And then in the world, evil people often get ahead. Well, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that's named for his great-grandfather, professor, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. I mentioned in his famous article on Rupture and Reconstruction that the 25th anniversary this year, I believe in that article where he writes the notion that crime doesn't pay, of course, isn't true. That's a crime doesn't pay is not a, it's not a physical lesson. It's a moral idea. And crime isn't right morally. Of course, crime pays. 90% of the people who cheat on taxes, 95% of them are never caught. You lie at the customs official. Well, of course, crime pays. Yeah, you do murder, chances are you'll get caught. Even there, but you do petty crime, chances are you're not going to get caught. So crime pays, but that's not what we mean. We don't, that's not how language works. So anyways, but that's, so the world has to work the way. So that's the one interpretation. We can't understand. The second interpretation, which I think is more interesting for us, like the first interpretation we sort of all realize. Second interpretation, this is talking about we live in a world, we live in a world where we don't really have righteous and evil the same way they used to. Ein biyadeinu, the wicked people today are not so wicked. Now, what does that mean exactly? So, again, you want to look at it in the world, even in world history, it's really true. I mean, as terrible things have happened, you know, the world is still a much safer place. There are much less wars going on today. I just saw yesterday in the paper that last night, unfortunately, they passed the 4 million. It's probably way higher, but the official death toll of COVID is about 4 million people now. They crossed the 4 million mark around the world. So they say that's the amount of people who've been killed in all the wars that have been fought in the world since 1982. So in other words, they're saying how terrible COVID is. that 4 million people have died. That's what, but 40 years of war and 4 million, I mean, of course it's terrible, but if you look at an historical, I was in Quebec last week, so we went to the Plains of Abraham, the 7 years war between France and England. I mean, the wars in Europe, they went on for hundreds of years and killing, and it was like awful. Today, in post-World War II world, it's been pretty peaceful, whatever. I'm not here to give political analysis, but you know what I'm trying to say. But that's not really what he's referring to, although he might. The way he explained it, the people today are not so wicked. Oh, that, in other words, first, we all say, you know, it's not their fault, they're not brought up that way. But I think it's also, the people, the average Jew today is much more learned than the average Jew in Talmudic times, or I'll put it more starkly. Oh. I would venture to guess that all people who are in this class this morning, thank you very much, all of you, are more learned than Rabbi Akiva was until the age of 40. There's no question you all know more than Rabbi Akiva. Now, at the age of 40, Rabbi Akiva decided to study, whatever, he met Rachel, whatever the story is. Rabbi Akiva was a total ignoramus. He hated Torah's God, he couldn't read. Rav Elazar HaGadol, who are the five best students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai? So one opinion we discussed a few minutes ago, Rav Elazar ben Arach was the best. The other opinion is Rav Elazar HaGadol was Rav Elazar HaGadol. The Gemara says he couldn't read Aleph Beit. He was 22 years old. He came to the base medrash of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. He didn't know how to read Hebrew. Today, any Jew who wants to, any connection to Yiddishkeit, even people who have very little connection, they all know how to read Hebrew. We know much more than the average Jew knew in Talmudic times. In Talmudic times, and I think that's commentary explaining, throughout our early points in history, the extremes were very wide. Of course, our Torah scholars don't reach the toenail of the Torah scholars of, you know, the Talmud. Maybe I shouldn't say that exactly, but yes, we don't have anybody of the stature of, forget the Abaye and Rava, the Rambam of Rashi, or the Netziv even, you know, it's very rare, you know, people. So our great Torah scholars are not as the level that they used to be, but also the average person, there's a much more coming to the middle. And if you look in the Talmud, there was a real disconnect between Torah scholars and non-Torah scholars. Nikiei Yerushalayim, the clean people, literally, that means the pious people of Jerusalem, they wouldn't eat a meal with an Am Haaretz. We use the term Am Haaretz to mean an ignorant Jew. They had a hatred for the Am Haaretz. I mean, the Am Haaretz had a hatred towards the rabbis. That's Rabbi Akiva says, he hated the rabbis. So we have that a little today too, but probably on a much lesser scale than was. That's what he's saying. We don't, our wicked people today, what do you want? They're living in the modern world. It's not their fault. That's what they're trying to say, that we don't have that same evilness, or we shouldn't view people as evil. At the same time, we don't have people with the same righteous level. In a sense, what he's saying, and he actually, I think, alludes to this, we should always view ourselves, that's how the Rambam writes, we should view ourselves as 50-50, where 50 people in the next act we're going to do. Anyways, I don't know, you can take it or leave it, maybe I didn't explain it properly, but the idea that we today don't have that big gap between Rishayim and Sadiqim, the someone who grow, we can move the fluid much more. We have much more in the middle. Okay, I don't know. But now the other content I saw in Sepharia, I never had heard of this person before. They have on Pirkei Avot, the commentary of Avigdor Shinan. So I looked him up on Wikipedia. He's a professor emeritus at Hebrew University. He was born in Prague and whatever. So he writes his sometimes interesting comments on the Pirkei Avot. So he said, this is a historical comment that Rav Yanai lived in the post Bar Kokhba revolution. And remember, that's 70 years after the destruction of the temple. They were hoping there would be the temple would be built. So he's saying, you know, it's not so bad anymore. The Romans are not persecuting us the way they used to, but it's not so good anymore either. We don't have a temple. In other words, we're living in times. What's a Charles Dickens, no? The best of times and the worst of times, right? So we can have them both at the same time. So he's sort of saying the same, but he's almost saying the opposite. They're not the best of times and they're not the worst of times. In other words, take your time. We always think this is the worst it's ever been, this is the best it's ever been. That's never always true. History repeats itself. So always, in other words, put things in historical perspective. We don't have it. You think it's so terrible now. It's not so terrible. People have gone through worse. You can get through this. And it's not so great that you can rest on your laurels. Okay, whatever that. Now, just to add a very important comment. The Tiferet Yisrael says, okay, we don't know why the wicked suffer, why the wicked prosper, the righteous suffer. He says, one should never say that, you know why that righteous person is suffering? He's not really righteous. He just looks righteous. He puts on a good show. Now, because we never know what people are truly like, right? As he said, Tocho Kiboro, right? The inside like the outside. That's the famous debate. Rabban Gamliel wouldn't let people in the Beit Midrash unless they were, as he called, Tocho Kiboro. He didn't know hypocrisy. They had to be pure on the inside, pure on the outside. How you can ever know if somebody's pure on the inside? You can't really know, but you can sort of see a little bit. So here's a, God forbid, you should say, ah, he's sunk because you're not a tzaddik. You know, that's the answer sometimes people give. And they give it as a theoretical concept, but maybe it's true theoretically. But you can't say it about any individual. That the reason this individual is suffering, really, if he was a true tzaddik, he wouldn't suffer. That's just a comment. Of course, it's very sad. You know, we hear these comments all the time. People have pipelines to God. Why this tragedy happens and why that tragedy happens. How now? So what you should all be jumping on me right now, considering it's Rosh Chodesh Av tomorrow, you should all be telling me, Rabbi, what the hell are you talking about? You're crazy. The rabbis do that all the time. The rabbis tell us the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, and the first temple because of idolatry, adultery, and murder. The second temple, the rabbis always tell us why things happen. So what do you mean you don't say? So first of all, you could answer that they're not talking about any individual person. They're talking about the collective. But maybe that's worse. Maybe that's better. But the real answer is, this is an important point. Maybe it's a little subtle, but it's very important. The rabbis are not telling us the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. That's not what the rabbis say. Maybe I'll talk about, I'm not sure yet. I haven't finished preparing exactly what I'm going to say, but, you know, on our Tishba program next week. So maybe I'll address some of this. I'm not sure. But you look in the Talmud, there are 15 different reasons why the temple was destroyed. They didn't act lifnei mishurat hadin, sinat chinam. The Gemara in Shabbat, on Daf, I think it's 119b, gives 7 different reasons why the Yerushalayim was destroyed. Well, what's going on here? So nobody, so the real answer, whenever you have 10 answers, it means no answer is good, right? Then the Chama Leib was famous. I mean, if Rashi has 2 answers, 2 comments, it means neither comment is perfect. Each comment has a problem. Yes. And the second comment, comment B solves a problem in comment A, but comment B also has a problem that's solved by comment A. Whenever you have 2 explanations, you don't need 2 explanations if 1 explanation is good. That's what you're supposed to learn in Yeshiva too. You don't need 15 explanations of the Rambam. If you have 1 good explanation, go on, whatever. So the rabbis give 10 different explanations. They have no idea why it was destroyed. How can they know? Now, why was it destroyed? The Romans were much more powerful. We were fighting with each other. When the rabbis say, we know the Jews are fighting with each other. Like, you know, so, you know, when you want to say we weren't worse. So here's a good example. You read Tanakh, Avodah Zarah. They were awful. You know, people don't like the secular state of Israel, this. Are you kidding? They are tzaddikim. They give billions of dollars every year to study Torah. The day of rest is Shabbos. Everything in the army, the whole country is kosher, public. We now have a prime minister who wears a kippah. Okay, forget politics. The state of Israel is unbelievable how they support Torah. Read what they did in Tanakh, what the kings, they put idolatry. They put roadblocks so Jews couldn't go up to Jerusalem to pray. We're way better. We're talking about, you know, we're not as bad as the bad. We're way, even the people who eat on Yom Kippur and are anti-religious are so more religious and so accommodating of religion than the people in Tanakh. If you read what Talmud or in Josephus, how the Jews were killing each other, literally, up into the second temple. They burned the food, the sikarim burned the food. They had enough food for Kalva Savua, Rabbi Akiva's father-in-law, Kalva Savua. I don't know what his real name was. I forget. I don't even know if we know. Kalva Savua means a satiated dog. So they said if you came in like hungry like a dog, you left total satiation. I mean, he had enough food to supply the whole of Jerusalem for 21 years, I think the Gemara said. But the zealots burned the food to force the Jews to fight. They were fighting each other, civil war. That's why the temple was destroyed, not because they didn't do leave. Now, it's true. These things display sinat chinam. It displays lifnei mishur din. But the rabbis, whenever the rabbis give a reason, they're not telling us why something happened. They're telling us what message can we learn for what happened. As we often have explained, right, Rav Soloveitchik beautifully says, there are no vowels in Hebrew. There are no nekudot. We put them in, right? So lamed mem hey. So we read it as lama. Why? It says lama shema zavtanu. Why, God, have you left us? Rav Soloveitchik, we're not supposed to read it lama. Lama, for what purpose? What do we learn from this that happened? So in one generation, the rabbi is going to say, you know why the temple was destroyed? Because there was hatred. You know why? Because the rabbi's not talking about the temple. He's talking to his congregants. He's talking to people alive. So in every generation, right, what does every rabbi do? That's what you're supposed to. You take a look at the parsha and you say, how does Reuven and Gad apply to us? You know, you apply the parsha to Maud. You interpret the parsha as you should, based on current events. That's what a darshan does, if he's a good darshan. We're not living in Europe in the ghetto. We're not living in Israel. I mean, so some of you may be living in Israel. You live in America, Canada, it's a little bit different than living in Israel. You have to apply the Torah to your living. So when the rabbis give 15 different reasons, each rabbi is talking to his own generation. What the Tiferet Yisrael is saying, you should never say to somebody, should never say, yeah, you're suffering because of X, Y, and Z. But the rabbis weren't doing that. We unfortunately just assume the rabbis say, okay, that's the reason. That's not what I don't think the rabbis mean that at all. The rabbis saying, what's the lesson we can learn from the destruction? But anyways, we can't understand. And then the Gemara continues, the Mishnah continues. Rav Matya ben Cheresh Omer, Havi Makdim Shalom L'chol Dam. I'll pick up on that week. I just want to end with, I don't know if you call it, I wouldn't call it a joke, but I just wanted to have his enough, Laura, you ought to be a tail on the lion, but rush the shulim, and don't be the head of the foxes, right? So, right, better to be, you know, the lion is the strongest animal, better to attach yourself, even if you're the tail of the lion, than to be the head of the foxes. And we'll pick up that a little bit, or maybe, and heavy makim shalom l'chol adam, you should be gracious, say hi to everybody. But Rav Matya ben Cheresh, first of all, so he appears one other time in the Mishnah, one other time, 2 days ago or 3 days ago in Daf Yomi. He basically says that you can use untested medicine. I think it's sort of an important thing for our words today. The Mishnah says it's Yom Kippur. Somebody was bitten by a rabid dog and his life is in danger. So they had this voodoo medicine or whatever that they would take the liver of the dog and feed it to you. So the rabbis say this isn't kosher. You can't do that. It's pikuach nefesh. It's not pikuach nefesh. That's ridiculous. That's not medicine. And Rav Matya ben Cheresh says you can do it. Maybe the psychological help, whatever. I just point that that's the only other time it's mentioned in the Mishnah about using untested medicine is allowed. It's very interesting for our time. But anyways, he says I'll just end and then I'll take review and I'll see a couple of questions perhaps. So I whenever I think of this mission, I always think of the comment of Freddie Potek. Now I'm going to test the baseball fans here. Anybody know Freddie Potek is? Am I pronouncing his name right? I forget. Freddie Potek. No, nobody knows. I'm a Ratzim here. No? Baseball, you don't know? So Freddie Potek was the shortstop for the Kansas City Royals in the 70s when they had George Brett and those, yeah, that's when they were good. He was a shortstop. He was also 5'5", and he was the shortest player in Major League Baseball. You know, being an athlete, it's not so easy to be 5'5". I mean, he wasn't the basketball player, but there have been a few basketball players under 6 feet. So he was the shortest player in the Major League Baseball. So they once asked, so I just remember his comment. It was such a beautiful comment. He must have learned our Mishnah. He said, I prefer to be the shortest player in the majors than the tallest player in the minors. So I thought that that's what Rav Moshe ben Cherish, be a lion, a tail on the line, be the shortest player in Major League Baseball. Yeah, you don't have to break all the scoring records. Hit 400 in the minor leagues doesn't mean much. Hit 400 in the major leagues or hit 300 in major leagues is better than 400 in the minor leagues. So that's just a cute, I always like to think of that. So baseball is not popular in the UK. I'm sorry, Claire. Maybe I know the European Cup. I don't follow soccer, but I can't avoid it. So here you go. We have the most, I believe Toronto is the most mixed city in the world. That's what they say, where the large, you know, with, you know, people from all walks of life with tremendous immigration here, you know, and whenever they have the World Cup, you shouldn't go into the areas where the flags, you know, the Portuguese and Italians and the Greeks, it's unbelievable. They all have their own neighborhood. So I know the European Cup is going on now or something, the Soccer Cup. So maybe I can give a good example. But unfortunately, I can't name one player who plays in the soccer league. I'm an Amharist there. Okay, let's just do a quick wrap up and then I'll comment on a couple of things. So we discussed a lot. Rav Elazar ben Aruch, right, going, being exiled and being exiled to the right places. Don't be exiled to the vacation for 5 years. And that's what the Mishnah says, learns from this heavy gola, the Makom Torah. We have to be proactive. You have to have a chavrusa. That's the criticism of the Rambam, perhaps. We discussed Nitziv and that, the whole story. And we discuss how the Gemara doesn't appear on half the Mishnah, right? The Gemara and the why, except with the exception of sacrifices, that when you learn about the sacrifices, if you brought them, that obviously doesn't mean it literally, but that's how the rabbis view it, different than all other areas of Jewish thought and practice. Only in sacrifice do we have that special notion that talking about it, when neshama parim sevatenu, is as if you brought it, and that's why their Gemara is about that. Then we discuss the Mishnah of Rav Yanai, the wicked and the righteous. We don't understand philosophically why the world is unfair, but the world has to be unfair, but it's still, we don't understand it. And we discuss that they're sort of, people are not so evil. They're much better than they used to be, even the wicked, and the righteous are not so righteous like they used to be either. And perhaps the historical idea that we should put our historic, we always think we're living, it's the worst, nobody ever had it, this, you know, the people, they're ein chadash tachat hashemesh, and we don't have it so bad. I say, maybe it's not so nice to say, I don't mean it a nice, listen, hopefully, please God, you know, the pandemic is much nearer to the end. I don't know if it's ever going to end 100%, but the end 99%, it'll be like the flu, hopefully, whatever. But, you know, as pandemics go, this is pretty light. You know, look, think of the Black Plague, think of smallpox. I mentioned many times that Eddie Reichman, we're having our medical conference on Sunday. Eddie Reichman is like the expert on the history of medicine. He's phenomenal. He's been speaking at 7 o'clock on Sunday. Even if you don't come to the rest, come to his talk. So he went 20th century, forget pre-20th century, 300 million people died of smallpox, at least in the 20th century. Smallpox. Before that, maybe billions, I don't know, have died in world history. So whatever, put life in perspective a little bit. That's what they're saying. And then we're saying it's good to attach yourself to the best. You want to be in the majors, not in the minors. Yeah. You want to be the worst player in the majors, not the best player in the minors. Okay, if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them. Let me comment. Debbie said there were Nevi'im who spoke about the sins of Bnei Israel during Brag Rishon. So a Nevi is different. When I said we don't have a pipeline to God, that's because we don't have any prophets. A prophet does have a pipeline to God. So that's the exact difference between the period of Tanakh and the period of Anshei Knesset Hagdola. That is beginning of Pirkei Avot, when we list off and we go Moshe to Sinai, the Sgenim, the Nevi'im, the Nevi'im, Anshei Knesset Hagdola. Anshei Knesset Hagdola had a few Nevi'im. That's where Soloveitchik always likes to point that out. Hayu Bakama Nevi'im. There were a few. They were the end period of the prophecy. Right. A prophet can tell us what we did wrong. And that may be more literally. And even there, you don't always have to interpret only literally. But we rabbis cannot know. And even the Talmudic rabbis could not know why it was. And that's why there's so many different opinions. And each one is going, because they're not really concerned about his. By the way, the rabbis had zero historical interest. rabbis had no interest in history. Like we were talking a little bit about intellectual history, you know, we spoke a little bit about today. The idea that we study history is new. Rabbinic biographies, I don't know when I mentioned that recently, I think last week, that's a new phenomenon. Whoever wrote rabbinic biographies, the rabbis, Rav Soloveitchik, they were always anonymous. They didn't want it. It's the rabbis had no historical sense. That's why many people say that was the big fight over Rabbi Slifkin's book, but it's not just him, that the rabbis, we don't have to follow the Talmudic historical account. I'm even if you don't realize it, I'm sure most of the people online already don't follow. If I could ask you, when was the first temple? When was it destroyed? Who wants to tell me? What year was the first temple destroyed?
586 BC.
Anybody disagree?
Yep, lots of people. There's 150 years.
Oh, Tova, do you know too much? Be quiet. Okay, so everybody here knows the temple was destroyed in 586 BC and left you. Pick up an art scroll book. Now, the problem is the second temple was in the year 70. 70 years in between means the second temple stood for close to 600 years. The problem is in the Talmud, it says it stood for 420 years. So without getting into that, but most people just assume the Talmud didn't care about history. That was just not the interest of the rabbis. It just wasn't. And who studied history in the ancient world? There was no. So what, they made mistakes. Big deal. It doesn't take away one iota from their greatness that they didn't know history. So some people today get very upset if you say that. But so the rabbis weren't telling us historically why was the temple destroyed. The rabbis were talking to the people in their generation. The prophets may have had more specific, but the prophets were also talking to their generation. They were telling us, learn what your ancestors did. Don't make the same mistakes they made, or don't oppress the poor, because then we're going to have to destroy the temple too. We're going to have to exile you. So that's what I think happened. Okay. Any other? Post-World War II was not so peaceful, is it? Yes, unfortunately it wasn't. But during World War II was a lot less. As the famous comment, you know, Yom HaShoah is to remind ourselves of the horrors of not having a state of Israel, and Yom HaZikaron is the horrors of having a state of Israel. But Yom HaZikaron is much, 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 much less than Yom HaShoah. 25,000, of course it's a terrible thing, but compared to 6 million, how can you compare? So yes, it wasn't so peaceful, but it's 1948 has been way more peaceful for Jews than before, and the world is a better. Okay, the books by Steven Pinker, somebody asking me directly, I'm not familiar with them. Yeshiva Shalavim bundled that book. What's the book of my uncle, the Nassiv? Wow, I'm surprised. I don't know Shalavim well. I'm not really familiar.
Yes,
I know last night, I know Rifke spoke very highly of Shalavim. I've actually never visited the yeshiva. I've never been to Shalavim, so I can't speak about that. Okay, what are the Torah sources for the Rambam rework 8, sleep 9? Sleep 8 hours. I think sleep 8 hours is, I don't think there's a Torah source for that. The Torah doesn't give us such specific things, but the Rambam was a doctor. So that's probably where the sleep 8 hours was, and working. He probably assumed that maybe it was true. You could make a living. Listen, there are people today. I mean, it's a much broader question. What do you do when you have $50 million, right? What do you earn? You made a lot of money by the age of 30. So Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, that you should have a profession Torah, applies even if you're wealthy. That's not just make money. But I would think that someone who has a lot of money should probably cut back on his hours a little bit. Doesn't have to work till 11 o'clock every night. It's a more complex problem, but I don't have to tell you that generally doesn't happen, because they want to be number one in the world. They got increased market share, whatever they want to do. But I don't think there's no specific source, but the Rambam is not that I'm aware of anyways, but the Rambam is assuming you work for 3 hours a day. That's enough to earn a basic living, and you learn 9 hours a day. It's like you read some of these Rambams, you're like, what's he talking about? Who can cut? Like, it's just not whatever. But okay. Anybody else has any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Zucker, we'll wait one moment. Just, I want to invite everyone. Of course you have a question. If you wouldn't have a question, I'd make you ask me a question. I'd ask you the question. I hope we'll see everybody on Sunday. No Rabbi Liebknecht class, but Avram Steinberg and Aaron Glad and Eddie Reichman and David Pelkovitz, and then our panel at night, Mark Dratch and Lori Novak and Rivka Press-Schwartz and Shlomo Weisman. So yeah, it's a great program. So I invite you. It's a totally different registration. You will not get in if you use the regular registration we have for all our classes. So you do have to register separately for that. There's no cost. I mean, you make a donation. If you want CME credits, any doctors want credits, that there is a little fee for. But otherwise, it's free like everything else. It's just, it's a totally separate login. And of course, on Monday morning, Rabbanit Shira Mervis will begin her series on rabbis from the Islamic world. And it should be very interesting. Of course, many of you maybe heard the interview we did with her a few weeks ago and we had with her and whatever. It should be interesting. And then all our regular classes, Rabbi Israel, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, Mr. Zucker, what would you like to ask?
This interesting thing was it's about the Netziv's book. Some people wanted to ban it.
Right.
You also mentioned Rabbi Zucker. Now, in that wonderful series that you run on Mondays, you know, that Rabbi Sacks, I think it's with Rabbi Israel. Now, they wanted to ban one of his books, I believe.
Yeah. The dignity of the... Listen, what can I tell you? Book banning, it's not Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh. It was worse. During the time of the Rambam or after the Rambam, we're coming up to Tisha B'Av. So the Rambam dies in 1204. There was controversy about the Rambam during his lifetime, but much less. Most of the controversy is after he died. And much of the controversy when he wrote in Arabic, except for the Mishnah Torah, he wrote everything in Arabic. And then it got translated. And it wasn't like today, you sent an email in the book. It could take 10 years from a book to go from Spain to Germany. It could take 25 years. Somebody writes a book in Spain. So, and after the Rambam dies and the books are translated, they reach France and the French rabbis have a heart attack, some of them. The Rambam's a heretic. What he writes is heretical. This story with Abram and the three angels was a dream and about the conception of God and study of philosophy is more important than the study of Talmud. And they caused the, in 1232, they had a big book burning of the Rambam. And then I spoke earlier on Rabbeinu Yonah, right? That was in today's year on Shari Tshuva, doing Tshuva, the brother-in-law of the Ramban. So Rabbeinu Yonah was alive then, and he was involved in the burning of the books of the Rambam. And then in 1242 in Paris, we have a kina for this on Tisha B'Av. Rav Meir of Rutenberg, the Maram of Rutenberg, wrote a kina, Shalis Rufa Ba'esh, the burning of 24 bookloads of Jewish books in Paris in 1242. And they thought that was it. There would be no Talmud that they don't have printing presses. You have to realize. And I believe only one or two manuscripts of Talmud did survive. They almost managed to destroy the Talmud. We have lost books to history. And the Rabbeinu, the Maram of Rutenberg composed a kina that we say on Tisha about this. And Rabbeinu Yonah did tshuva. As he puts it, he said, and he said that, I believe, he said that the reason this is happening is a punishment. That the Jews can burn the books of the Rambam, so why can't the Goyim burn our books? So this was a punishment for burning the books of the Rambam, and the Rabbeinu Yonah did, quote-unquote, I think he refers himself as doing tshuva about the way he attacked the Rambam. So book burning as an old thing. We were in Germany on our trip a few years ago with, Mark Shapiro, when we used to do trips, please God soon, again. But you go to one place where they burnt the books, and I forget who was a German historian who said, in a place where they burn books, they will soon burn people.
Yes.
Begin by burning books and you begin people. So Baruch Hashem, even Rabbi Slipkin's books were not burned. Nobody in the world, not all the people who put the books in the Cherem. First of all, they put the books in the Cherem. They didn't put him in the Cherem. It's very interesting. I don't know what that means exactly. In the time of the Rambam, they didn't put their books in the Cherem. They put you in the Cherem. And they say, no, they distinguish between the author and what he writes. I don't know why. If I write a book that contains heresy, so I'm a heretic. Well, though it's not my books are heresy and I'm not a heretic, but... whatever, that's what they say somehow. The books contain heresy, but he's not a heretic. I don't exactly understand how that works, but Beseder. So it's not as bad as it once. But they burn books, unfortunately. They banned books. So that's what I said, you want to get your books banned. They didn't say you want to get them burnt. The truth that burning books won't help today. You can't burn them in the Middle Ages. I'll end with one story, unless people have more questions. Though the Ramchal, somebody this week mentioned Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. Who mentioned him? Somebody remind me. Maybe
Rifki Pointer.
I'm sorry.
Rifki.
It was Rifki mentioned him last night. The Ramchal, right. So Ramchal was a fascinating figure. He was became an optometrist. So the Ramchal, they basically put him to cherem. And he had, and today he's like the father of the Musar movement, the most important Musar book ever written, Mesili Sharim. But that book is not supposed to be around. That book, there was an agreement to burn all his books, to hide all his books. He was Epicurus, and whatever he had, was writing, thing, he was a Kabbalist doing all kinds of things the rabbis didn't like. And they didn't like his writing, so he agreed that they agreed he'll leave town. I don't know the exact story. He'll agree, they'll take all his books, they'll bury them, so you know nothing, you won't publicize your books, and you go away. And I think he moved to Amsterdam and then to Italy, became an optometrist, I believe, because he couldn't work in the field of the rabbinate anymore, like in Jewish study, I don't know. And his books were all banned, were all meant to be destroyed from Jewish history. And I don't know how exactly the Mesilat Yesharim, either he kept a copy, whatever it is, the Mesilat Yesharim survived. And today, you know of the Ramchal, so God works, I don't know, God, man works in mysterious ways, you know, and strange things happen. They tried to get rid of them. And the Rambam too, obviously, believe me, the rabbis who burned the books of the Rambam, when they were burning them, would have been very happy had none of us ever heard of the Rambam. Had the Rambam been lost in Jewish history, that would not have bothered them at all. But it doesn't work that way. So anyways, halavai, they should ban. I did get somebody this week, by the way, if somebody wants to actually rope me, I haven't had this in a long time, on my piece in Pirkei Avot that I sent earlier this week, A Broken Transmission, when I wrote about Kivlu Mehem from Pirkei Avot. We discussed it last year, how because the tradition, Hillel and Shammai, broke into two, so the Masor was no longer passed on. So somebody wrote to me, why do you write this heresy?
Ooh.
So I actually asked them to clarify what's heretical about it. I said, I'm quoting the Tosfot Yontif, and I gave him all my sources. And of course, not surprisingly, I didn't get a response. But okay, no. It's but I much prefer, at least he read what I wrote. Most people don't even read. Baruch Hashem, he read it, so he calls me a heretic. But say there, that's okay. Anyways, okay. Any other questions? Otherwise, we wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. Please, God, we'll see you many times next week. And of course, like I said, when we have an all-day Tisha B'Av program, you saw it's posted on the website. We haven't sent out an email yet, from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m. So 8 hours. You'll pass the time. You won't be hungry. You'll lower av lalechem velot samei lamayim kim l'torat Hashem. You're going to want the Torah of God, so we'll learn. And by the time we finish, the fast will almost be over. And if you live in Israel, fast will be over early. In the middle, fast will be over, I don't know, 8 o'clock. Okay. Anyway.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much.
Shabbat Shalom.
We still have Simcha now. Doesn't say there's no Simcha. Mema'atim. We have less Simcha. We're happier in Adar than Av, but you're supposed to be happy in Av. A Jew should always be happy. Yivduat Hashem b'simcha. Should always be happy, even in Av, even in the month of Av.
Amen.
Maybe Tisha B'Av is the only day you have an excuse not to be happy.
And if that's the worst of Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Yeah.